So, before we get into some stuff from Buds, which I'm really excited to share with the readers, I know you are, let's just recap that, because what you're talking about here is mindset. Isn't that right?
Exactly. It's all about mindset, and throughout this whole book, you're going to realize that it's going to always come back to one thing, mindset, and it's your mindset. It's how you speak to yourself, and it's also where you want to be at.
So that means constantly monitoring what you're thinking and so that you're controlling it. You know, I always think about don't believe everything you feel, because sometimes you might feel a certain way about some person or about some situation, but that first feeling isn't necessarily going to get you anything. It's not going to be a solution. It's usually something to ignore, wouldn't you say?
Oh, 100%. Life is all about feelings, and a lot of times we create this reality, and it's a false reality. And we live in this false reality, and it starts to control our lives. And it takes a really strong person. It has to come from you. You have to create. It's not creating at all. You have to go to the real reality. Sometimes it's not as bad as you've made it out to be. And, you know, it all comes when, you know, for instance, like, basically life is relentless. It just keeps coming at you, man. So you gotta be, you know, be prepared for it.
You know, I was reading yesterday, Nelson Mandela on his way out of prison. You know, he was wrongfully imprisoned for, 20 years or more. I forget exactly the number, decades, by white supremacists in South Africa. And on his way out, he knew, he's written about this. He knew he had to leave the bitterness behind him or he'd never be free.
Exactly.
And that's mindset, isn't it?
It's 100% mindset. Like, for instance, life is going to constantly come at you. So we have to control the things we can control. Like, for instance, this morning, I woke up this morning and we got out of here pretty late yesterday. And I went home, got back to the room about, you know, midnight and did my 2 hour stretching. And I woke up at about 6 o'clock this morning and went for a 7 mile run. I do all these things, not because I enjoy them, because I know once I leave my house, a lot of things are out of my control. So I am trying to win these small battles, win these, you know, try to just have these small victories that I can take with me outside. So once I leave my house, if I've gotten up in the morning and I've, you know, done my routine as far as like going for a run, doing my push-ups, doing my pull-ups, I am basically trying to prepare my mind for the challenges that are going to come my way that I cannot control. So you always have to always constantly start to kind of get your mind ready for what's to come.
Perfect. And I think that's the perfect transition into Taking Souls, the next chapter. Just so you guys are clued in, this is day two here in the recording studio. It's a beautiful day outside, and we are in separate dark cubicles wired together.
Yes, man. I am back in the box.
We're in the box.
We're in the box, man. Nothing in life is going to, you know, it's not going to be ideal. We are always looking for an ideal situation. Everything has to be perfect for us to succeed. That is not what it's about. We have to be super, we have to be great in a situation that is not always perfect.
And if there's one thing about Hell Week, is it wasn't perfect, was it?
No, it was never perfect, but you had to find something more. That's what Taking Souls is all about. You had to find strength when there was no strength around. You had to, so sometimes you had to invent strength.
Chapter 4, Taking Souls. The first concussion grenade exploded at close range, and from there, everything unraveled in slow motion. 1 minute, we were chilling in the common room, bullshitting, watching war movies, getting pumped up for the battle we knew was coming. Then that first explosion led to another, and suddenly Psycho Pete was in our faces, screaming at the top of his lungs. His cheeks flushed candy apple red, that vein in his right temple throbbing. When he screamed, his eyes bugged out, and his whole body shook. Break the fuck out! Move! 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 My boat crew sprinted for the door single file, just like we'd planned. Outside, Navy SEALs were firing their M60s into the darkness towards some invisible enemy. It was the bad dream we'd been waiting for our entire lives, the lucid nightmare that would define or kill us. Every impulse we had told us to hit the dirt, but at that moment, movement was our only option. The repetitive, deep bass thud of machine gun fire penetrated our guts. The orange halo from another explosion in the near distance provided a shock of violent beauty, and our hearts hammered as we gathered on the grinder, awaiting orders. This was war, all right, but it wouldn't be fought on some foreign shore. This one, like most battles we fight in life, would be won or lost in our own minds. Psycho Pete stomped the pocked asphalt, his brow slick with sweat, the muzzle of his rifle steaming in the foggy night. "Welcome to Hell Week, gentlemen," he said, calmly this time, in that sing-song Cali surfer drawl of his. He looked us up and down like a predator eyeing his kill. "It will be my great pleasure to watch you suffer." Oh, and there would be suffering. Psycho set the tempo, called out the push-ups, sit-ups, and flutter kicks, the jumping lunges and dive bombers. In between, he and his fellow instructors hosed us down with freezing water, cackling the whole damn time. There were countless reps and set after set, with no end in sight. My classmates were gathered close, each of us on our own stenciled frog footprints, overlooked by a statue of our patron saint, the Frogman, a scaly alien creature from the deep, with webbed feet and hands, sharp claws, and a motherfucking six-pack. To his left was the infamous brass bell. Ever since that morning when I came home from cockroach duty and got sucked into the Navy SEAL show, it was this place that I'd sought. The grinder. A slab of asphalt dripping with history and misery. Bud's training is 6 months long and divided into three phases. First phase is all about physical training, or PT. Second phase is dive training, where we learn how to navigate underwater and deploy stealthy, closed-circuit diving systems that emit no bubbles and recycle our carbon dioxide into breathable air. Third phase is land warfare training. But when most people picture buds, they think of first phase, because those are the weeks that tenderize new recruits, until the class is literally ground down from about 120 guys to the hard, gleaming spine that are the 25 to 40 guys who are more worthy of the trident, the emblem that tells the world we are not to be fucked with. Bud's instructors do that by working guys out beyond their perceived limits, by challenging their manhood, and insisting on objective physical standards of strength, stamina, and agility. Standards that are tested. In those first 3 weeks of training, we had to, among other things, climb a vertical 10-meter rope, hammer a half-mile-long obstacle course studded with American Ninja Warrior-type challenges in under 10 minutes, and run 4 miles on the sand in under 32 minutes. But if you ask me, all that was child's play. It couldn't even compare to the crucible of first phase. Hell Week is something entirely different. It's medieval, and it comes at you fast, detonating in just the third week of training. When the throbbing ache in our muscles and joints was ratcheted up high, and we lived day and night with an edgy, hyperventilating feeling of our breath getting out front of our physical rhythm, of our lungs inflating and deflating, like canvas bags squeezed tight in a demon's fists, for 130 hours straight. That's a test that goes way beyond the physical and reveals your heart and character. More than anything, it reveals your mindset, which is exactly what it's designed to do. All of this happened at the Naval Special Warfare Command Center on prissy-ass Coronado Island, a Southern California tourist trap that tucks into slender Point Loma and shelters the San Diego Marina from the open Pacific Ocean. But even Cali's golden sun couldn't pretty up the grinder, and thank God for that. I liked it ugly. That slab of agony was everything I'd ever wanted. Not because I loved to suffer, but because I needed to know whether or not I had what it took to belong. Thing is, most people don't. By the time Hell Week started, at least 40 guys had already quit, and when they did, they were forced to walk over to the bell, ring it 3 times, and place their helmet on the concrete. The ringing of the bell was first brought in during the Vietnam era, because so many guys were quitting during evolutions and just walking off to the barracks. The bell was a way to keep track of guys, But since then, it's become a ritual that a man has to perform to own the fact that he's quitting. To the quitter, the bell is closure. To me, every clang sounded like progress. I never liked Psycho much, but I couldn't quibble with the specifics of his job. He and his fellow instructors were there to cull the herd. Plus, he wasn't going after the runts. He was in my face plenty, and guys bigger than me, too. Even the smaller dudes were studs. I was one man in a fleet of alpha specimens from back east and down south, the blue-collar and big-money surf beaches of California, a few from corn country like me, and plenty from the Texas rangeland. Every Bud's class has their share of hard-ass backcountry Texans. No state puts more seals in the pipeline. Must be something in the barbecue, but Psycho didn't play favorites. No matter where we were from or who we were, he lingered like a shadow we couldn't shake, laughing, screaming, or quietly taunting us to our face, attempting to burrow into the brain of any man he tried to break. Despite all that, the first hour of Hell Week was actually fun. During breakout, that mad rush of explosions, shooting, and shouting, you are not even thinking about the nightmare to come. You're riding an adrenaline high because you know you're fulfilling a rite of passage within a hallowed warrior tradition. Guys are looking around the grinder, practically giddy, thinking, yeah, we're in Hell Week, motherfuckers. Ah, but reality has a way of kicking everyone in the teeth sooner or later. You call this putting out? Psycho Pete asked no one in particular. This may be the single sorriest class we ever put through our program. You men are straight up embarrassing yourselves. He relished this part of the job, stepping over and between us, his boot print in our pooling sweat and saliva, snot, tears, and blood. He thought he was hard. All the instructors did. And they were, because they were SEALs. That fact alone placed them in rare air. You boys couldn't have held my jock when I went through Hell Week, I'll tell you that much. I smiled to myself and kept hammering as Psycho brushed by. He was built like a tailback, quick and strong. But was he a mortal fucking weapon during his Hell Week? Sir, I doubt that very fucking much, sir. He caught the eye of his boss, the first phase officer in charge. There was no doubt about him. He didn't talk a whole lot, and didn't have to. He was 6'1", but he cast a longer shadow. Dude was jacked, too. I'm talking about 225 pounds of muscle, wrapped tight as steel, without an ounce of sympathy. He looked like a silverback gorilla, and loomed like a godfather of pain, making silent calculations, taking mental notes. Sir, my dick's getting stiff just thinking about these gaping vaginas, weeping and quitting like whiny little bitches this week, Psycho said. SBG offered half a nod as Psycho stared through me. Oh, and you will quit, he said softly. I'll make sure of that. Psycho's threats were spookier when he delivered them in a relaxed tone like that, but there were plenty of times when his eyes went dark, his brow twisted, the blood rushed to his face, and he unleashed a scream that built from the tips of his toes to the crown of his bald head. An hour into Hell Week, he knelt down, pressed his face within an inch of my own while I finished another set of push-ups and let loose. Hit the surf, you miserable fucking turds! We'd been in Buds for nearly 3 weeks by then, and we'd raced up and over the 15-foot berm that divided the beach from the cinderblock sprawl of offices, locker rooms, barracks, and classrooms that is the Buds compound plenty of times. Usually to lie back in the shallows, fully dressed, then roll in the sand, until we were covered in sand from head to toe, before charging back to the grinder, dripping heavy with salt water and sand, which ramped up the degree of difficulty on the pull-up bar. That ritual was called getting wet and sandy, and they wanted sand in our ears, up our noses, and in every orifice of our body. But this time we were on the verge of something called surf torture, which is a special kind of beast. As instructed, we charged into the surf, screaming like senseis. Fully clothed, arms linked, we waded into the impact zone. The surf was angry that moonless night, nearly head high, and the waves were rolling thunder that barreled and foamed in sets of 3 and 4. Cold water shriveled our balls and swiped the breath from our lungs as the waves thrashed us. This was early May, and in the spring, the ocean off Coronado ranges from 59 to 63 degrees. We bobbed up and down as one, a pearl strand of floating heads scanning the horizon for any hint of swell we prayed we'd see coming before it towed us under. The surfers in our crew detected doom first and called out the waves so we could duck dive just in time. After 10 minutes or so, Psycho ordered us back to land. On the verge of hypothermia, we scrambled from the surf zone and stood at attention while being checked by the doctor for hypothermia. That cycle would continue to repeat itself. The sky was smeared orange and red. The temperature dropped sharply as night loomed close. "Say goodbye to the sun, gents," SBG said. He made us wave at the setting sun, a symbolic acknowledgement of an inconvenient truth. We were about to freeze our natural asses off. After an hour, we fell back into our six-man boat cruise and stood nut to butt, huddling tight to get warm, but it was futile. Bones were rattling up and down that beach. Guys were jackhammering and sniffling, a physical state revealing the quaking conditions of splintering minds, which were just now coming to grips with the reality that this shit had only just begun. Even on the hardest days of first phase, prior to Hell Week, when the sheer volume of rope climbs and push-ups, pull-ups and flutter kicks crushes your spirit, you can find a way out, because you know that no matter how much it sucks, you'll head home that night, meet friends for dinner, see a movie, maybe get some pussy, and sleep in your own bed. The point is, even on miserable days, you can fixate on an escape from hell that's real. Hell Week offers no such love, especially on day one, when an hour in they had us standing, linking arms, facing the Pacific Ocean, waiting in and out of the surf for hours. In between, we were gifted soft sand sprints to warm up. Usually they had us carry our rigid inflatable boat or a log overhead. But the warmth, if it ever arrived, was always short-lived, because every 10 minutes they rotated us back into the water. The clock ticked slowly that first night as the cold seeped in, colonizing our marrow so thoroughly the run stopped doing any good. There would be no more bombs, no more shooting, and very little yelling. Instead, an eerie quiet expanded and deadened our spirit. In the ocean, all any of us could hear were the waves going overhead, the seawater we accidentally swallowed roiling in our guts, and our own teeth chattering. When you're that cold and stressed, the mind cannot comprehend the next 120-plus hours. 5.5 days without sleep cannot be broken up into small pieces. There is no way to systematically attack it, which is why every single person who has ever tried to become a SEAL has asked himself one simple question during their first dose of surf torture. Why am I here? Those innocuous words bubbled up in our spinning minds each time we got sucked under a monster wave at midnight, when we were already borderline hypothermic. Because nobody has to become a SEAL. We weren't fucking drafted. Becoming a SEAL is a choice. And what that single softball question revealed in the heat of battle is that each second we remained in training was also a choice, which made the entire notion of becoming a SEAL seem like masochism. It's voluntary torture, and that makes no sense at all to the rational mind, which is why those four words unravel so many men. The instructors know all of this, of course, which is why they stopped yelling early on. Instead, as the night wore on, Psycho Pete consoled us like a concerned older brother. He offered us hot soup, a warm shower, blankets, a ride back to the barracks. That was the bait he set for quitters to snap up, and he harvested helmets left and right. He was taking the souls of those who caved because they couldn't answer that simple question. I get it. When it's only Sunday and you know you're going to Friday, and you're already far colder than you've ever been, you're tempted to believe that you can't hack it, and that nobody can. Married guys were thinking, I could be at home cuddled up to my beautiful wife instead of shivering and suffering. Single guys were thinking, I could be on the hunt for pussy right now. It's tough to ignore that kind of glittering lure. But this was my second lap through the early stages of BUDS. I'd tasted the evil of Hell Week as part of Class 230. I didn't make it, but I didn't quit. I was pulled out on a medical after contracting double pneumonia. I defied doctor's orders 3 times and tried to stay in the fight, but they eventually forced me to the barracks and rolled me back to day 1, week 1, of Class 231. I wasn't all the way healed up from that bout of pneumonia when my second BUDS class kicked off. My lungs were still filled with mucus, and each cough shook my chest and sounded like a rake was scraping the inside of my alveoli. Still, I liked my chances a lot better this time around, because I was prepared, and because I was in a boat crew thick with bad motherfuckers. BUDS boat crews are sorted by height, because those are the guys who will help you carry your boat everywhere you go once Hell Week begins. Size alone didn't guarantee your teammates will be tough, however. And our guys were a crew of square peg misfits. There was me, the exterminator, who had to drop 100 pounds and take the ASVAB test twice just to get to SEAL training, only to be rolled back almost immediately. We also had the late Chris Kyle. You know him as the deadliest sniper in Navy history. He was so successful, the Hajis in Fallujah put an $80,000 bounty on his head, and he became a living legend among the Marines he protected as a member of SEAL Team 3. He won a Silver Star and 4 Bronze Stars for valor, left the military, and wrote a book, American Sniper, that became a hit movie starring Bradley fucking Cooper. But back then, he was a simple Texas hayseed rodeo cowboy who barely said a damn word. Then there was Bill Brown, a.k.a. Freak Brown. Most people just called him Freak, and he hated it because he'd been treated like one his whole damn life. In many ways, he was the white version of David Goggins. He came up tough in the river towns of South Jersey. Older kids in the neighborhood bullied him because of his cleft palate or because he was slow in class, which is how that nickname stuck. He got into enough fights over it that he eventually landed in a youth detention center for a 6-month stretch. By the time he was 19, he was living on his own in the hood, trying to make ends meet as a gas station attendant. It wasn't working. He had no coat and no car. He commuted everywhere on a rusted-out 10-speed bike, literally freezing his balls off. One day after work, he stopped into a Navy recruitment office because he knew he needed structure and purpose and some warm clothes. They told him about the SEALs, and he was intrigued, but he couldn't swim. Just like me, he taught himself, and after 3 attempts, he finally passed the SEAL swim test. Next thing he knew, Brown was in Buds, where that freak nickname followed him. He rocked PT and sailed through first phase, but he wasn't nearly as solid in the classroom. Navy SEAL dive training is as tough intellectually as it is physically, but he scraped by and got within 2 weeks of becoming a Buds graduate, when in one of his final land warfare evolutions, he failed reassembling his weapon in a timed evolution known as weapons practical. Brown hit his targets but missed the time, and he flunked out of Buds at the bitter end. But he didn't give up. No, sir, Freak Brown wasn't going anywhere. I'd heard stories about him before he washed up with me in Class 231. He had 2 chips on his shoulders, and I liked him immediately. He was hard as hell and exactly the kind of guy I signed up to go to war with. When we carried our boat from the grinder to the sand for the first time, I made sure we were the 2 men at the front, where the boat is at its heaviest. "Freak Brown," I shouted, "we will be the pillars of boat crew too." He looked over, and I glared back. "Don't fucking call me that, Goggins," he said with a snarl. "Well, don't you move out of position, son. You and me, up front, all fucking week." "Roger that," he said. I took the lead of Boat Crew 2 from the beginning, and getting all 6 of us through Hell Week was my singular focus. Everyone fell in line because I'd already proven myself, and not just on the grinder. In the days before Hell Week began, I got it into my head that we needed to steal the Hell Week schedule from our instructors. I told our crew as much one night when we were hanging in the classroom, which doubled as our lounge. My words fell on deaf ears. A few guys laughed, but everyone else ignored me and went back to their shallow-ass conversations. I understood why. It made no sense. How are we supposed to get a copy of their shit? And even if we did, wouldn't the anticipation make it worse? And what if we got caught? Was the reward worth the risk? I believed it was, because I'd tasted Hell Week. Brown and a few other guys had too, and we knew how easy it was to think about quitting when confronted with levels of pain and exhaustion you didn't think possible. 130 hours of suffering may as well be 1,000 when you know you can't sleep and that there will be no relief anytime soon. And we knew something else, too. Hell Week was a mind game. The instructors used our suffering to pick and peel away our layers, not to find the fittest athletes, to find the strongest minds. That's something the quitters didn't understand until it was too late. Everything in life is a mind game. Whenever we get swept under by life's dramas, large and small, we are forgetting that no matter how bad the pain gets, no matter how harrowing the torture, all bad things end. That forgetting happens the second we give control over our emotions and actions to other people, which can easily happen when pain is peaking. During Hell Week, the men who quit felt like they were running on a treadmill turned way the fuck up, with no dashboard within reach. But whether they figured it out or not, that was an illusion they fell for. I went into Hell Week knowing I put myself there, that I wanted to be there, and that I had all the tools I needed to win this fucked up game, which gave me the passion to persevere and claim ownership of the experience. It allowed me to play hard, bend rules, and look for an edge wherever and whenever I could until the horn sounded on Friday afternoon. To me, this was war, and the enemies were our instructors, who'd blatantly told us that they wanted to break us down and make us quit. Having their schedule in our heads would help us whittle the time down, by memorizing what came next. And more than that, it would gift us a victory going in, which would give us something to latch onto during Hell Week when those motherfuckers were beating us down. "Yo, man, I'm not playing," I said. "We need that schedule." I could see Kenny Bigby, the only other black man in class 231, raise an eyebrow from across the room. He'd been in my first Buds class and got injured just before Hell Week. Now he was back for seconds, too. "Oh, shit," he said. "David Goggins is back on the log." Kenny smiled wide, and I doubled over, laughing. He'd been in the instructor's office, listening in when the doctors were trying to pull me out of my first Hell Week. It was during a log PT evolution. Our boat crews were carrying logs as a unit up and down the beach, soaked, salty, and sandy as shit. I was running with a log on my shoulders, vomiting blood. Bloody snot streamed from my nose and mouth, and the instructors periodically grabbed me and sat me down nearby because they thought I might drop fucking dead. But every time they turned around, I was back in the mix, back on that log. Kenny kept hearing the same refrain over the radio that night. "We need to get Goggins out of there," one voice said. "Roger that, sir. Goggins is sitting down," another voice crackled. Then after a beat, Kenny would hear that radio chirp again. "Oh shit, Goggins is back on the log. I repeat, Goggins is back on the log." Kenny loved telling that story. At 5'10" and 170 pounds, he was smaller than I was and wasn't on our boat crew, but I knew we could trust him. In fact, there was nobody better for the job. During class 231, Kenny was tapped to keep the instructor's office clean and tidy, which meant that he had access. That night, he tiptoed into enemy territory, liberated the schedule from a file, made a copy, and slipped it back into position before anyone ever knew it was missing. Just like that, we had our first victory before the biggest mind game of our lives had even begun. Of course, knowing something is coming is only a small part of the battle, because torture is torture, and in Hell Week, the only way to get past it is to go through it. With a look or a few words, I made sure our guys were putting out at all times. When we stood on the beach holding our boat overhead or running logs up and down that motherfucker, we went hard. And during surf torture, I hummed the saddest and most epic song from Platoon while we waded into the Pacific Ocean. I hope the listeners and the readers have seen that movie. What a great movie.
Oh, man, it was seriously one of the most epic movies of all time.
And that is like the ultimate scene, right?
Yes. Yes. So there were several scenes in this movie that I took along with me as fuel. And there was a time when Elias, so this, you know, Platoon's about Barnes and Elias. And there was a scene where Barnes couldn't stand Elias, and he ends up shooting Elias. And the platoon is taken off in a chopper, and, you know, Barnes told everybody that Elias was dead because, he shot Elias, and Elias went down in the woods or in the jungle, and so he left him for dead. So they start taking off in these choppers, and Charlie Sheen looks out of the chopper and sees Elias, you know, he's been all shot up from Barnes, and the Viet Cong is chasing this guy through the jungle, and they're just shooting him. And you see this guy who's just trying to get to the chopper, and he's like, he's falling down, and they keep on shooting him. He keeps on getting up, and he's falling down. In the very last scene, you see William Dafoe, who is Elias. He's on his knees, and he raises his arms up in the air as the choppers are going overhead. And the Viet Cong kind of like shoot him in his back for his last times, and he kind of falls down on the ground. It's an epic scene, man, but it's just that music from that sound, you know, from the actual movie, man, it was just epic. And, you know, it just helped me out so much.
Yeah, but it helped you out not because of the drama, because it was kind of comedy. Like, you were saying that you were doing that for your guys, right?
Right. I was doing it for my guys, but what it did, it went from comedy to almost... That song would almost like put them in a trance. I was like almost transforming their mind. So it went from being very funny to being almost like, all right, it's time to get to work now.
Hmm.
And so it became a very powerful song for us, or at least for my boat crew.
Yeah, for your boat crew, more than the other guys, right? Because, you know, everyone's stretched out in the ocean. It's really just your boat crew that can hear it.
Right, right. It got pretty loud, though.
Did everyone join in?
No, you know what? I think that's when I started getting a very unique reputation for the guy who smiled when everything got so fucked up in Hell Week. And at its worst is when I found strength.
Hmm.
And I was able to dig down when I saw everybody's face kind of hanging down low, and I saw it was extremely horrible. I would come up with something epic, like that song or something else.
I've always found inspiration in film. Rocky helped motivate me to achieve my dream of being invited to SEAL training, but Platoon would help me and my crew find an edge during the dark nights of Hell Week, when the instructors were mocking our pain, telling us how sorry we were, and sending us into the head-high surf over and over again. Adagio and Strings was the score to one of my favorite scenes in Platoon, and with bone-chilling fog wrapping all around us, I stretched my arms out like Elias when he was getting gunned down by the Viet Cong and sang my ass off. We'd all watched that movie together during first phase, and my antics had a dual effect of pissing off the instructors and firing up my crew. Finding moments of laughter in the pain and delirium turned the entire melodramatic experience upside down for us. It gave us some control of our emotions. Again, this was all a mind game, and I damn sure wasn't going to lose. But the most important games within the game were the races that the instructors set up between boat crews. Damn near everything in Buds was a competition. We'd run boats and logs up and down the beach. We had paddle races, and we even did the damn O course carrying a log or a boat between obstacles. We'd carry them while balancing on narrow beams over spinning logs and across rope bridges. We'd send it high over the wall, and we dropped it at the foot of the 30-foot-high cargo net while we climbed up and over that damn thing. The winning team was almost always rewarded with rest, and the losing teams got extra beatdowns from Psycho Pete. They were ordered to perform sets of push-ups and sit-ups in the wet sand, then do berm sprints, their bodies quivering with exhaustion, which felt like failure on top of failure. Psycho let them know it, too. He laughed in their face as he hunted quitters. "You are absolutely pathetic," he said. "I hope to God you fucking quit, because if they allow you in the field, you're going to get us all killed." Watching him berate my classmates gave me a dual sensation. I didn't mind him doing his job, but he was a bully, and I never liked bullies. He'd been coming at me hard since I got back to Buds, and early on I decided I would show him that he couldn't get to me. Between bouts of surf torture, when most guys stand nut to butt to transfer heat, body to body, I stood apart. Everyone else was shivering. I didn't even twitch, and I saw how much that bothered him. The one luxury we had during Hell Week was chow. We ate like kings. We're talking omelets, roast chicken and potatoes, steak, hot soup, pasta with meat sauce, all kinds of fruit, brownies, soda, coffee, and a lot more. The catch is we had to run the mile there and back with that 200-pound boat on our heads. I always left Chow Hall with a peanut butter sandwich tucked in my wet and sandy pocket to scarf on the beach when the instructors weren't looking. One day after lunch, Psycho decided to give us a bit more than a mile. It became obvious at the quarter-mile marker, when he picked up his pace, that he wasn't taking us directly back to the grinder. "You boys better keep the fuck up," he yelled. As one boat crew fell back, I checked my guys. "We are staying on this motherfucker. Fuck him." "Roger that," said Freak Brown. True to his word, he'd been with me on the front of that boat, the two heaviest points, since Sunday night, and he was only getting stronger. Psycho stretched us out on the soft sand for more than 4 miles. He tried like hell to lose us, too, but we were his shadow. He switched up the cadence. One minute he was sprinting, then he was crouching down, wide-legged, grabbing his nuts and doing elephant walks. Then he loped at a jogger's pace before breaking into another wind sprint down the beach. By then, the closest boat was a quarter mile behind, but we were clipping his damn heels. We mimicked his every step and refused to let our bully gain any satisfaction at our expense. He may have smoked everybody else, but he did not smoke Boat Crew 2. Hell Week is the devil's opera, and it builds like a crescendo, peaking in torment on Wednesday and staying right there until they call it on Friday afternoon. By Wednesday, we were all broke dick, chafed to holy hell. Our whole body was one big raspberry, oozing pus and blood. Mentally, we were zombies. The instructors had us doing simple boat raises, and we were all dragging. Even my crew could barely lift that boat. Meanwhile, Psycho and SBG and the other instructors kept close watch, looking for weaknesses, as always. I had a real hate for the instructors. They were my enemy, and I was tired of them trying to burrow into my brain. I glanced at Brown, and for the first time all week, he looked shaky. The whole crew did. Shit, I felt miserable too. My knee was the size of a grapefruit, and every step I took torched my nerves, which is why I was searching for something to fuel me. I locked in on Psycho Pete. I was sick of that motherfucker. The instructors looked composed and comfortable. We were desperate, and they had what we needed, energy. It was time to flip the game and own real estate in their heads. When they clocked out that night and drove home after a pussy-ass 8-hour shift while we were still going hard, I wanted them thinking about boat crew too. I wanted to haunt them when they slipped into bed with their wives. I wanted to occupy so much space in their minds that they couldn't even get it up. To me, that would be as powerful as putting a knife in their dick. So I deployed a process that I now call taking souls. I turned to Brown. "You know why I call you freak?" I asked. He looked over as we lowered the boat, then lifted it up overhead like creaky robots on reserve battery power. "Because you are one of the baddest men I've ever seen in my damn life." He cracked a smile. "And you know what I say to these motherfuckers right here?" I tipped my elbow at the 9 instructors gathered on the beach, drinking coffee and talking bullshit. "I say they can go fuck themselves." Bill nodded and narrowed his eyes on our tormentors, while I turned to the rest of the crew. "Now let's throw this shit up high and show them who we are." "Fucking beautiful," Bill said. "Let's do it." Within seconds, my whole team had life. We didn't just lift the boat overhead and set it down hard. We threw it up, caught it overhead, tapped the sand with it, and threw it up high again. The results were immediate and undeniable. Our pain and exhaustion faded. Each rep made us stronger and faster, and each time we threw the boat up, we all chanted, "You can't hurt boat crew too." That was our fuck you to the instructors, and we had their full attention as we soared on a second wind. On the toughest day of the hardest week in the world's toughest training, Boat Crew 2 was moving at lightning speed and making a mockery of Hell Week. The look on the instructors' faces told a story. Their mouths hung open like they were witnessing something nobody had ever seen before. Some averted their eyes, almost embarrassed. Only SBG looked satisfied. Since that night in Hell Week, I've deployed the Taking Souls concept countless times. Taking Souls is a ticket to finding your own reserve power and riding a second wind. It's the tool you can call upon to win any competition or overcome every life obstacle. You can utilize it to win a chess match or conquer an adversary in a game of office politics. It can help you rock a job interview or excel at school. And yes, it can be used to conquer all manner of physical challenges. But remember, this is a game you are playing within yourself. Unless you're engaged in physical competition, I'm not suggesting that you try to dominate someone or crush their spirit. In fact, they never even need to know you're playing this game. This is a tactic for you to be your best when duty calls. It's a mind game you're playing on yourself. Taking someone's soul means you've gained a tactical advantage. Life is all about looking for tactical advantages, which is why we stole the Hell Week schedule, why we nipped Psycho's heels on that run, and why I made a show of myself in the surf, humming the platoon theme song. Each of those incidents was an act of defiance that empowered us. But defiance isn't always the best way to take someone's soul. It all depends upon your terrain. During BUDS, the instructors didn't mind if you looked for advantages like that. They respected it, as long as you were also kicking ass. You must do your own homework. Know the terrain you're operating in, when and where you can push boundaries, and when you should fall in line. Next, take inventory of your mind and body on the eve of battle. List out your insecurities and weaknesses, as well as your opponents. For instance, if you're getting bullied, and you know where you fall short or feel insecure, you can stay ahead of any insults or barbs a bully may throw your way. You can laugh at yourself along with them, which disempowers them. If you take what they do or say less personally, they no longer hold any cards. Feelings are just feelings. On the other hand, people who are secure with themselves don't bully other people. They look out for other people. So if you're getting bullied, you know that you're dealing with someone who has problem areas you can exploit or soothe. Sometimes the best way to defeat a bully is to actually help them. If you can think two or three moves ahead, you will commandeer their thought process. And if you do that, you've taken their damn soul without them even realizing it. Our SEAL instructors were our bullies, and they didn't realize the games I was playing during that week to keep boat crew too sharp, and they didn't have to. I imagine that they were obsessed with our exploits during Hell Week, but I don't know that for sure. It was a ploy I used to maintain my mental edge and help our crew prevail. In the same way, if you are up against a competitor for a promotion and you know where you fall short, you can shape up your game ahead of your interview or evaluation. In that scenario, laughing at your weaknesses won't solve the problem. You must master them. In the meantime, if you are aware of your competitor's vulnerabilities, you can spin those to your advantage. But all of that takes research. Again, know the terrain, know yourself, and you'd better know your adversary in detail. Once you're in the heat of battle, it comes down to staying power. If it's a difficult physical challenge, you will probably have to defeat your own demons before you can take your opponent's soul. That means rehearsing answers to the simple question that is sure to rise up like a thought bubble. Why am I here? If you know that moment is coming and have your answer ready, you will be equipped to make the split-second decision to ignore your weakened mind and keep moving. Know why you're in the fight to stay in the fight. And never forget that all emotional and physical anguish is finite. It all ends eventually. Smile at pain and watch it fade for at least a second or two. If you can do that, you can string those seconds together and last longer than your opponent thinks you can, and that may be enough to catch a second wind. There is no scientific consensus on second wind. Some scientists think it's the result of endorphins flooding your nervous system. Others think it's a burst of oxygen that can help break down lactic acid, as well as glycogen and triglycerides muscles need to perform. Some say it's purely psychological. All I know is that by going hard when we felt defeated, we were able to ride a second wind through the worst night in Hell Week. And once you have that second wind behind you, it's easy to break your opponent down and snatch a soul. The hard part is getting to that point, because the ticket to victory often comes down to bringing your very best when you feel your worst. That's some knowledge right there. So, you know, you want to walk us through that concept that you developed and how that all happened?
Yes. So this was years and years in the making, and taking souls is probably one of the most medieval things I do, you know, so my whole mind works very different than most people's. And so I came up with this by kind of realizing how weak my mind was. I hated people being better than me. This is why I got, you know, so insecure. I hated so many different things. So I started studying my own mind, and I realized that a lot of people need to realize that there are so many insecure people out there. And I knew from studying my mind that even these Navy SEALs, these instructors that had already gone through Navy SEAL training, were supposed to be the elite of the elite, badasses, whatever. I knew that they all have demons. They don't want alpha males, especially alpha males. They hate seeing anyone be better than them. And so what I realized going through Hell Week is I knew that these alpha males, these Navy SEAL instructors, they were all on the beach judging us. They were sitting there in their parkas, nice and warm, drinking their coffees, and they were judging all the students, saying, okay, yeah, when I was in Tuesday of Hell Week, I was better than that fucking guy right there, and I was better than that guy on Wednesday and all this stuff. So you have to know the human mind and how it works. So I knew that all I have to do right now to crack these men is I have to just find a little more strength. And so when they're imagining themselves on Wednesday, you know, they're imagining themselves being beat down, being like, oh my God, man, I can't wait till Friday. So I knew that. I knew where their mind was at. Even though they were warm, they weren't wet, they were thinking about themselves at the time I was at. And I was like, you know what? How can I do this? I was like, well, all I have to do is own some real estate in their mind. I have to show them that at their worst time in their life, I am at my best time. And I knew that that would totally fuck them up. So I kind of got my guys together, and we went crazy, as you know, as you just read. And what it did was they literally stopped fucking with Boat Crew 2. Because they realized then, hey, there's no way in hell we can get to these guys because I literally took their soul. And I guarantee you, when they went home that night, there was no sex that night. Because they were thinking about not getting some, but they were thinking about, man, how the fuck did that boat crew do what I could have never done?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's something that probably no boat crew had ever done, where you're actually, and it's really strategic. It's almost like an illusion. You guys were still suffering just like everybody else, but you found that much more to do something that they hadn't even conceived of themselves. And that's what was shocking, right?
And that's the whole thing about it, Adam. All you have to do to take someone's soul, let's say you're running and you're neck for neck with a guy or a girl, whatever it may be, you have to last one more second. Let's say you're doing a marathon and at the 18 mile point, this guy's waiting for you to break. Once you break that person and that person drips off you, you can literally slow down.
Mm.
That person's broke.
Mm.
You have taken that whole mindset now is just broken. It's just lasting one more second longer than the person beside you. And then you broke them.
Yeah, you're both feeling the same pain. It's
exactly.
Not like you don't feel the pain.
Right, the pain is there. It's that person that can last a little bit longer or find the tactical advantage when everybody around you is suffering to say, okay, man, if I can muster up just enough strength. But what happens is, like that second win you're talking about, it's a lot more powerful than the second win, because it was almost like day one for us. It was Wednesday, and by us looking at, it's called the look. I looked at everybody around us and they had this look of disbelief that how the fuck are they doing that? So you're riding all these different emotions from, they're like, how the fuck is Boat Crew 2 doing it? And it's literally just jacking you up even more and more and more, watching all the disbelief around you.
Yeah. So you're feeling the pain. Then you start doing this thing, still feeling the pain. And then all of a sudden you're riding the energy wave.
Exactly. And it's truly an amazing thing. It works in all kinds of situations. Not just physical. It can be anything. When you're doing something that most people think is impossible, and that is what it's all about. You're just kind of cracking a code a little bit to where everybody can do. Anybody can do it. But you're just going to the next level. You're kind of taking off all these perceived limitations. Like everybody, they tell you on Wednesday, you start getting tired. They've been saying this for 70 years. On Wednesday of Hell Week, everybody gets tired. So what happens is that gets in your head.
Mm.
So you believe what another man told you, not how you feel. So you get to Wednesday and your mind says, oh, everybody said I'm tired, so I must be tired. I didn't believe shit. I wasn't taking in all this knowledge from previous classes. I was like, you know what? They're not me. Don't take in what someone else felt.
Hmm.
Feel what you feel. Make that be your reality. Don't let their reality be your reality. So that's all it is. Like we always say in the book, life is one big mind game, but usually you're playing against yourself.
Yeah, because, scientists have looked at like the way our minds operate, and we're basically always, the human mind is always trying to find the easier path. Basically, it's always trying to find the easier path. So that's why mindset is so important, because you're basically continually having to push your mind towards the harder path, which ultimately gets you a lot more.
And that's very true, because the mind has so much information in it that the reason why it does that is not so much for weakness. It has so much information in it that it's trying to say, okay, this is too much information, let's go this way. So that's all it's doing, man. You have to reprogram it to say, oh, no, we're not doing that today. So usually the mind has the advantage over you. You have to get, this is your mind. This is your mind. We forget that. We think that this mind is somebody else's.
Yes.
And it's just walking you through life aimlessly. No. It is your mind. You must get it and program it to do what you want it to do at that specific time.
Beautiful. You said that after that, they stopped fucking with Boat Crew 2, but they didn't stop fucking with you. We're about to get into a scene here, which is pretty medieval.
You know what? And this is what happens also, man. When you kind of rub people the wrong way with having this kind of mindset, they're going to look for any advantage they can or any kind of opportunity they can to break your spirit. Because why? You just broke their spirit. You broke their spirit by making them feel less of a person. Mm. That's what it was all about to me. Hell Week and Buds, it was a war. Those instructors were the enemy. I was not friends with them. I did not like them. I challenged them, and I went to war with them, and a lot of them didn't like me. But that's what I was looking for.
After rocking boat presses, the whole class was gifted an hour of sleep in a big green army tent they'd set up on the beach and outfitted with military cots. Those motherfuckers had no mattresses, but may as well have been a cotton-topped cloud of luxury, because once we were horizontal, we all went limp. Oh, but Psycho wasn't done with me. He let me sleep for a solitary minute, then woke me up and led me back onto the beach for some one-on-one time. He saw an opportunity to get in my head at last, and I was disoriented as I staggered toward the water all alone. But the cold woke me the fuck up. I decided to savor my extra hour of private surf torture. When the water was chest high, I began humming Adagio in strings once more. Louder this time. Loud enough for that motherfucker to hear me over the crash of the surf. That song gave me life. I'd come to SEAL training to see if I was hard enough to belong and found an inner beast within that I never knew existed. A beast that I would tap into from then on whenever life went wrong. By the time I emerged from that ocean, I considered myself unbreakable. If only. Hell Week takes its toll on everybody, and later that night, with 48 hours to go, I went to MedCheck to get a Toradol shot in my knee to bring the swelling down. By the time I was back on the beach, the boat crews were out at sea in the midst of a paddling drill. The surf was pounding, the wind swirling. Psycho looked over at SBG. What the fuck are we going to do with him? For the first time, he was hesitant and tired of trying to beat me down. I was good to go, ready for any challenge, but Psycho was over it. He was ready to give my ass a spa vacation. That's when I knew I'd outlasted him, that I had his soul. SBG had other ideas. He handed me a life jacket and attached a chem light to the back of my hat. Follow me, he said, as he charged up the beach. I caught up and we ran north for a good mile. By then we could barely see the boats and their bobbing lights through the mist and over the waves. All right, Goggins, now go swim out and find your fucking boat. He'd landed a hollow point on my deepest insecurity, pierced my confidence, and I was stunned silent. I gave him a look that said, are you fucking kidding me? I was a decent swimmer by then, and surf torture didn't scare me because we weren't that far from shore. But an open water, hypothermic swim, 1,000 yards offshore in a storm, to a boat that had no fucking idea I was heading their way, that sounded like a death sentence, and I hadn't prepared for anything like it. But sometimes the unexpected descends like chaos. And without warning, even the bravest among us must be ready to take on risks and tasks that seem beyond our capabilities. For me, in that moment, it came down to how I wanted to be remembered. I could have refused the order, and I wouldn't have gotten in trouble because I had no swim buddy. In SEAL training, you always have to be with a swim buddy. And it was obvious that he was asking me to do something that was extremely unsafe. But I also knew that my objective coming into SEAL training was more than making it through to the other side with a trident. For me, it was the opportunity to go up against the best of the best and distance myself from the pack. So even though I couldn't see the boats out past the thrashing waves, there was no time to dwell on fear. There was no choice to make at all. What are you waiting on, Goggins? Get your fucking ass out there, and do not fuck this up. Roger that, I shouted, and sprinted into the surf. Trouble was, strapped to the buoyancy vest, nursing a wounded knee, wearing boots, I couldn't swim for shit, and it was almost impossible to duck dive through the waves. I had to flail over the whitewash, and with my mind managing so many variables, the ocean seemed colder than ever. I swallowed water by the gallon. It was as if the sea was prying open my jaws and flooding my system, and with each gulp, my fear magnified. I had no idea that back on land, SBG was preparing for a worst-case scenario rescue. I didn't know he'd never put another man in that position before. I didn't realize that he saw something special in me, and like any strong leader, wanted to see how far I could take it, as he watched my light bob on the surface, nervous as hell. He told me all of that during a recent conversation. At the time, I was just trying to survive. I finally made it through the surf and swam another half mile offshore, only to realize I had 6 boats bearing down on my head, teeter-tottering in and out of view, thanks to a 4-foot wind swell. They didn't know I was there. My light was faint, and in the trench I couldn't see a damn thing. I kept waiting for one of them to come barreling down from the peak of a swell and mow me the fuck down. All I can do is bark into the darkness like a hoarse sea lion. Boat crew 2! Boat crew 2! It was a minor miracle that my guys heard me. They wheeled our boat around, and Freak Brown grabbed me with his big-ass hooks and hauled me in like a prized catch. I lay back in the middle of the boat, my eyes closed, and jackhammered for the first time all week. I was so cold I couldn't hide it. "Damn, Goggins," Brown said. "You must be insane. You okay?" I nodded once and got a hold of myself. I was the leader of that crew and couldn't allow myself to show weakness. I tensed every muscle in my body, and my shiver slowed to a stop in real time. "That's how you lead from the motherfucking front," I said, coughing up salt water like a wounded bird. I couldn't keep a straight face for long. Neither could my crew. They knew damn well that a crazy-ass swim wasn't my idea. Dude, I gotta stop right there. I mean, not everybody who reads this or hears this is gonna know how it is in the ocean.
Right.
But, like, the thing about the ocean, it does come down to variables, right? Like, people who aren't familiar with getting out in open water, at first, like, just the sheer water could make them feel uncomfortable because it's a place you're not supposed to be. You know, it's hostile to human life out there. It's beautiful, but it can be hostile to human life. And then you're adding on the night. You're adding on a wind, wind swell and a stormy kind of sea. You're adding on being fully dressed where you can't even move. You know, those variables, each one of those is like exponential difficulty.
Well, let's not forget also, Adam, that I haven't slept yet.
Right. That's a variable.
You know, my whole, I've been up since Sunday and it's now, you know, what, Wednesday night?
I mean.
And my whole boat crew has, you know, everybody has gotten at least 1 hour of sleep.
Yeah.
And I have been up the whole time, man, and I am fucked.
Well, I mean, you know who's going to, like, appreciate this the most is, like, the people who are in the ocean all the time. Like, surfers, even big wave surfers are going to read this, and they're going to be like, holy fucking shit.
Well, and people have no idea how hard it is to have that big-ass life jacket.
Yes.
On, you know, and you're literally just bobbing.
Yeah, because you can't move around.
No, you can't move, man. Yeah. So I would, like, swim and get pushed back in. And so what's not on here is how many times I got, you know, literally pushed back on to the daggone beach.
Yeah, because it takes a crazy amount of strength to actually, you're actually now become a boat yourself.
Right. So like So I was going up and down the beach trying to find the right break to just try to get out past them. And it was a brutal, brutal.
Yeah, you had to ride the rip, right? You had to find a rip tide that could just pull you out.
Exactly. It was horrible.
As the clock ran down on Hell Week, we were in the demo pit, just off Coronado's famous Silver Strand. The pit was filled with cold mud and topped off with icy water. There was a rope bridge, 2 separate lines, one for the feet and one for the hands, stretching across it from end to end. One by one, each man had to navigate their way across while the instructors shook the shit out of it, trying to make us fall. To maintain that kind of balance takes tremendous core strength, and we were all cooked and at our wits' end. Plus, my knee was still fucked. In fact, it had gotten worse and required a pain shot every 12 hours. But when my name was called, I climbed onto that rope, and when the instructors went to work, I flexed my core and held on with all I had left. 9 months earlier, I had topped out at 297 pounds and couldn't even run a quarter mile. Back then, when I was dreaming of a different life, I remember thinking that just getting through Hell Week would be the biggest honor of my life so far. Even if I never graduated from BUDS, surviving Hell Week alone would have meant something. But I didn't just survive. I was about to finish Hell Week at the top of my class. And for the first time, I knew I was a bad motherfucker. Once I was so focused on failing, I was afraid to even try. Now I would take on any challenge. All my life I was terrified of water, and especially cold water. But standing there in the final hour, I wished the ocean, wind, and mud were even colder. I was completely transformed physically, which was a big part of my success in BUDS. But what saw me through Hell Week was my mind, and I was just starting to tap into its power. That's what I was thinking about as the instructors did their best to throw me off that rope bridge like a mechanical bull. I hung tough and got as far as anyone else in class 231, before nature won out, and I was sent spinning into the freezing mud. I wiped it from my eyes and mouth and laughed like mad as Freak Brown helped me up. Not long after that, SBG stepped to the edge of the pit. "Hell Week secure!" he shouted to the 30 guys still left, quivering in the shallows. All of us chafed and bleeding, bloated and stiff. "You guys did an amazing job." Some guys screamed with joy. Others collapsed to their knees with tears in their eyes and thanked God. I stared into the heavens too, pulled Freak Brown in for a hug, and high-fived my team. Every other boat crew had lost men, but not Boat Crew 2. We lost no men and won every single race. We continued to celebrate as we boarded a bus to the grinder. Once we arrived, there was a large pizza for each guy, along with a 64-ounce bottle of Gatorade and the coveted brown T-shirt. That pizza tasted like motherfucking manna from heaven, but the shirts meant something more significant. When you first arrive at Bud's, you wear white T-shirts every day. Once you survive Hell Week, you get to swap them out for brown shirts. It was a symbol that we'd advanced to a higher level, and after a lifetime of mostly failure, I definitely felt like I was someplace new. I tried to enjoy the moment like everyone else, but my knee hadn't felt right in 2 days, and I decided to leave and see the medics. On my way off the grinder, I looked to my right and saw nearly 100 helmets lined up. They belonged to the men who'd rung the bell, and they stretched past the statue, all the way to the quarterdeck. I read some of the names, guys who I liked. I knew how they felt because I was there when my pararescue class graduated without me. That memory had dominated me for years, but after 130 hours of hell, it no longer defined me. Every man was required to see the medics that evening, but our bodies were so swollen they had a hard time discerning injuries from general soreness. All I knew was my right knee was thrice fucked, and I needed crutches to get around. Freak Brown left MedCheck bruised and battered. Kenny came out clean and barely limped, but he was plenty sore. Thankfully, our next evolution was Walk Week. We had 7 days to eat, drink, and heal up before shit got real once again. It wasn't much, but enough time for most of the insane motherfuckers that managed to remain in Class 231 to get well. Me, on the other hand? My swollen knee hadn't gotten any better by the time they snatched my crutches away. But there was no time for boo-hooing. First phase fun wasn't over yet. After Walk Week came knot tying, which may not sound like much, but was way worse than I expected, because that particular drill took place at the bottom of the pool, where those same instructors would do their best to drown my one-legged ass. It was as if the devil had been watching the whole show, waited out intermission, and now his favorite part was coming right up. The night before Bud's kicked back up in intensity, I could hear his words ringing in my stressed-out brain as I tossed and turned all night long. "They say you like suffering, Goggins, that you think you're a bad motherfucker. Enjoy your extended stay in hell." So, man, Goggins, I mean, that is crazy. So you get through Hell Week.
Right.
That's a milestone for anybody, and especially for you, where you'd come from and how hard you've been fighting. And you already know your body's fucked.
Yeah, man, I knew for a fact that there's going to be, you know, a little bit more training ahead of me. And I'm not talking about with my class. I had a feeling that something bad was going to happen to me. But, you know, my knee was so messed up that I went in and actually stole a whole bunch of Motrin. So you're supposed to go to the doc. So during med check, I think you have about maybe 2 or 3 med checks a day. I'm not quite for sure. I know you have one during the day, you know, during the morning, I think one in the afternoon maybe, and then one at night, or maybe just one in the day, one at night, not for sure. But I actually went in and stole a whole bunch of Motrin. And by this time, it was my second Hell Week, so I knew kind of where I was going to be at, you know, different evolutions and whatnot. So I would, you know, stage Motrin in the sand. Mm. So I was probably taking about 10 of these a day, and these are 800 milligrams. And the most you're supposed to take is 3. You know, 1 for breakfast, 1 for lunch, and 1 for dinner. And I was popping them, man, like Tic Tacs. And I was just trying to get through this thing because I knew that, you know, I was just trying to get through the whole program.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally fighting each second is its own battle, right? Like, each minute is its own battle. You're just staying one after another, stringing them together.
100%. And I didn't want to... So I was like my bro crew leader. Mm. So the whole thing about being a leader is you just cannot show weakness. And the second you start limping around or things start getting tough, your mind is going to, once again, take control. And if I would have limped around and that pain would have got even more than what it was, you know, my whole bow crew would have fed off of me, you know, kind of dragging my leg behind me. And, you know, it's infectious.
Yeah, you don't know who else would have might have crumbled.
Exactly. Weakness is infectious. So my bro crew saw that my knee was the size of a grapefruit. Mm. And I was like, fuck it, let's go. So that was also infectious. Mm. So having that kind of mindset, I knew I had to bring that, not just for myself. And that's a whole nother thing about being a leader, is I realized the more you think about yourself when you're going through hell, the harder hell's going to be. The second you start looking after everybody else and start, you know, being concerned about them, you no longer think about yourself. And when you don't think about yourself, you're not trapped in your own thoughts. You're not trapped in your own hell. And so that's what I did. And the more I thought about my boat crew and getting them through every evolution, us being the best, you know, I didn't worry about my fucking knee. But the second hell week was over, that pain was real.
Yeah. You had a purpose bigger than yourself as the leader, which actually helped you achieve more. But then when it comes to the body, if you're injured, you're injured.
Exactly. And yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Well, we'll get into that later. But first, we have a challenge here that kind of, what I like about this challenge you've got here is you're kind of walking through again the practice of taking souls and showing how it can apply to different areas in life.
Right, right.
So I'll read through it and we can talk a little bit more about it.
Roger that.
Challenge 4. Choose any competitive situation that you're in right now. Who is your opponent? Is it your teacher or coach? Your boss? An unruly client? No matter how they're treating you, there is one way to not only earn their respect, but turn the tables. Excellence. That may mean acing an exam, or crafting an ideal proposal, or smashing a sales goal. Whatever it is, I want you to work harder on that project or in that class than you ever have before. Do everything exactly as they ask, and whatever standard they set as an ideal outcome, you should be aiming to surpass that. If your coach doesn't give you time in the games, dominate practice. Check the best guy on your squad and show the fuck out. That means putting time in off the field, watching film so you can study your opponent's tendencies, memorizing plays, and training in the gym. You need to make that coach pay attention. If it's your teacher, then start doing work of high quality. Spend extra time on your assignments. Write papers for her that she didn't even assign. Come early to class. Ask questions. Pay attention. Show her who you are and want to be. If it's a boss, work around the clock. Get to work before them. Leave after they go home. Make sure they see that shit. When it's time to deliver, surpass their maximum expectations. Whoever you're dealing with, your goal is to make them watch you achieve what they could never have done themselves. You want them thinking how amazing you are. Take their negativity and use it to dominate their task with everything you've got. Take their motherfucking soul. Afterward, post it on social and add the hashtag, #can't hurt me, #taking souls. You know, I love that because your goal here is to take it out of the physical. I mean, yes, if it's a team sport or something where a coach has control, it's really a power dynamic game you're playing.
It is. And this takes me back to when, you know, we talked about me in high school and how much I loved basketball and how between, you know, my junior year, I got cut from the basketball team because, you know, I was just pissed off and I didn't want to go to daggone summer practice and stuff like that. And I still tried out. And when the first cuts came, I got cut first cuts, man. And that took my soul. But as my mind started changing and I started realizing what I was doing to myself, I started realizing, you know what, I have to dominate next year. So what I did was I came back the very next year and instead of shooting the ball all the time, because I knew the coach didn't like me. For whatever reason, the coach didn't like me at all. So I literally became one of the best defensive players in the state of Indiana. And I say that loud and proud because I went from a guy who shot the ball and was trying to become like, you know, everybody loves the guy that scores the points. I became the grittiest motherfucker on the daggone basketball court. So taking souls is also another way of don't let anybody get the advantage over you. You have to change your mindset, find where you can get the advantage, and then dominate that area.
You turn yourself into the kind of player every coach had to put on the floor.
Exactly.
Because you changed the game in a way without having to need the ball.
Exactly. I took the decision-making out of his hands. There's not one coach on the planet Earth that doesn't want a defensive stopper.
Yeah.
So that's what I knew, and that's what I became.
Yeah, and it's great. It's great for any young people reading this or people who have kids who are not getting the time that they'd hoped to. Gives them ways, you know, dominating practice is a great thing. Check their best player. And if you can hold their best play, the best player on your team to nothing in a practice game, you're going to play.
Exactly what happened, man. I was in practice, man, busting my ass, and I just changed my whole mindset. I flipped it.
But, you know, the idea of power dynamics is so important because, you know, in Hell Week, you're not in the power position. The instructors are. In life, we always have people. I mean, it's very rare that you're not in a situation where there's some power dynamic that you have to deal with, whether it's a client or a boss or a teacher. They're always there. And so, you know, it's how do you manage that relationship? And what you're saying is manage it by being great, and your greatness will melt all the problems that you have.
That is true, but one thing you have to be careful for, taking souls is a very powerful, powerful thing, and it can piss a lot of people off. So what you have to understand is you have to do it with humility. And that was some of the things I got caught up in where I was, you know, there's a time and a place to where, you know, you can't be so humble. And when I was going through SEAL training, it was mano a mano. So that was a place where I wanted them to feel pain. Because they were putting me through pain. But there's a lot of situations when you're using this, you know, when you're using this tactic, it is, you have to be careful because you can piss your boss off. You can piss people off. So do it with the understanding of you're trying to be your best. You are trying to be your very, very best in a time when everybody else is kind of tired. And that pisses people off. For you being a so-called overachiever, it makes people look at you very differently.
Yeah, so know that going in, but still do it.
Oh, yes, 100% still do it, but know that going in for sure.